A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about fish in Israel. The country's got the Mediterranean on one side and the Sea of Galilee up north, but fish has never really been a big part of the local diet the way it is in, say, Greece or Turkey. He wants to know what's actually swimming in these waters, which species are worth eating, whether overfishing is a problem, and if you're someone who cares about eating fish ethically, where you'd go for a genuinely good fish restaurant. It's basically a guided tour through Israel's underwater real estate, with dinner at the end.
I love this, because most people, even Israelis, couldn't name five local fish species if you put a plate in front of them. And yet the Eastern Mediterranean is one of the most historically fished bodies of water on Earth. You've got Phoenician fish salting operations from 3,000 years ago along this coast. There's a whole submerged world people just don't think about.
The phrase, historically fished, is doing a lot of work there. 3,000 years of humans pulling things out of the same stretch of water, you'd think we'd have either perfected it or emptied it by now.
That's exactly the tension. The Mediterranean off Israel's coast, we're talking about the Levantine Basin, which is the southeastern corner of the Med. It's actually not the most naturally productive marine ecosystem. It's warm, it's salty, it's relatively low in nutrients compared to, say, the Aegean or the Adriatic. The Nile used to pump enormous amounts of nutrient-rich sediment into this part of the Mediterranean, but the Aswan Dam basically shut that off in the 1960s, so the whole ecosystem shifted.
Wait, the Aswan Dam in Egypt changed Israel's fish stocks.
The Nile flood pulse used to create this massive plume of fresh water and nutrients that spread along the Levantine coast. Sardine stocks collapsed after the dam was built. Egypt's own sardine fishery dropped from about 18,000 tons a year to almost nothing within a few years. Israel felt it too. The whole food web contracted.
The fish were basically living off Egypt's agricultural runoff for millennia, and we didn't realize it until someone turned off the tap.
That's a very corn way of putting it, but yes. And it's one reason the Eastern Mediterranean is considered oligotrophic, nutrient poor, compared to other marine systems. But that doesn't mean there's nothing there. You've got a mix of native species and, increasingly, invasive species coming through the Suez Canal.
Right, the Lissepsian migration. That's the thing where Red Sea species come up through the canal into the Mediterranean.
Named after Ferdinand de Lesseps, who built the Suez Canal. And it's one of the most dramatic marine invasions on the planet. Over 100 fish species have crossed from the Red Sea into the Mediterranean since the canal opened. Some of them have completely reshaped the local fishery. We'll get to those.
Let's start with what's native. If I'm standing on the beach in Tel Aviv, and I look out at the water, what's actually swimming out there?
The native fish community in the Levantine Basin. And I pulled some of this from Israeli fishery surveys and a few marine biology papers. You've got several families that matter both ecologically and commercially. First, the sperids. That's the sea bream family. The most important native sperids include the gilt-head sea bream, which in Hebrew is Dennis. That's probably the most famous premium fish in Israel.
Dennis is the one that shows up on every respectable menu.
Silver, with that distinctive gold band between the eyes, hence gilt-head. It's a coastal fish, lives in seagrass beds and sandy bottoms, and it's a protandrous hermaphrodite, which is a fun fact I'm going to force you to hear.
I'm braced.
They all start as males and then transition to female as they get larger. So the big Dennis you want on your plate, that's a female. Commercially, most Dennis you eat in Israel today is farmed, not wild. And we'll get to aquaculture because that's its own whole story. But wild Dennis is still caught, just in much smaller numbers.
What else is in the sperid family?
You've got the common Pandora, that's Farida in Hebrew, which is a smaller bream, pinkish, very delicate flesh. There's the white sea bream, which is called Sargus. There's the striped sea bream. And then there's a fish called Shefernoon in Hebrew, which is the Selema, or dream fish, Sarpa Salpa. And that one has a bizarre property. If you eat the head of a Sarpasalpa, particularly during certain seasons, you can experience hallucinations. It's been documented since Roman times. The fish accumulates indole alkaloids from the algae it eats, and those compounds can produce LSD-like effects.
Somewhere off the coast of Herzliya, there's a psychedelic sea bream just swimming around, waiting to ruin someone's Tuesday.
Or make it. The Romans reportedly used it recreationally. There are accounts of Arab physicians in the medieval period writing about it. It's not a common food fish in Israel today, for obvious reasons, but it's absolutely part of the local ichthyofauna.
The walking encyclopedia strikes again. All right, beyond the breams.
The grouper family, that's the Serranids. The dusky grouper, Epinephilus marginatus, is the big one. In Hebrew, it's Dakar. It's a large, long-lived, reef-associated predator. Can grow to 1.5 meters, weigh over 60 kilos. It's one of the most prized fish in the Mediterranean. And it's also one of the most threatened.
Because it takes so long to mature.
Groupers are slow-growing, late-maturing, and they aggregate to spawn in specific locations at predictable times, which makes them incredibly vulnerable to overfishing. A dusky grouper might not reach sexual maturity until it's 7 or 8 years old. If you catch it before then, it never reproduces. And because they command high prices, there's intense pressure on wild stocks.
The Dakar on a menu is a bit of a red flag.
We'll get to the sustainability question. But yes, wild dusky grouper is a concern throughout the Mediterranean. There's also the white grouper, Epinephilus aeneus, which is slightly less threatened, but similar story. And the gold blotch grouper, which is actually a Lacepsian migrant, came through the Suez, but has established itself and is now commercially fished.
Before we get deeper into the invasives, what else is native and worth knowing about?
You've got the mullets, that's the mugalids. The flathead gray mullet is called berry in Hebrew, and it's enormously important in Israeli fish culture. Mullet is the fish used for dag semicheks, literally happy fish, which is the classic Israeli preparation, fried mullet fillets, often served with tahina. It's a coastal fish, tolerates a wide range of salinities, and it's also the primary fish farmed in Israeli aquaculture going back decades.
Dag semach is basically the national fish dish, if Israel had one.
It's the closest thing. Mullet is not a fancy fish, it's not Dennis or Dakar. But it's beloved, it's affordable, and it's deeply embedded in the food culture. You also have the red mullet, which is a completely different fish. That's Mullus barbatus or Mullus sermuletus, called mullet in Hebrew, sometimes translated as Sultan Ibrahim in English. Small, pinkish, very delicate. It was prized in ancient Rome. Apicius has recipes for it. And it's still considered a delicacy.
The ancient Romans, again, they really got around the Mediterranean seafood scene.
They were obsessive about fish. There's a reason garum, fermented fish sauce, was one of the most traded commodities in the Roman Empire, but I'll spare you the garum tangent. Moving on, you got the bluefish, which is called tarsan in Hebrew. It's a migratory predator, aggressive, travels in schools, and it's popular among recreational anglers because it fights hard. The flesh is oily and strong-flavored. Some people love it, some find it fishy in a bad way. It's divisive.
The cilantro of fish.
That's actually perfect. Then there's the little tunny, Atlantic bonito, or palamada in Hebrew, which is a small tuna species, very common in Israeli waters seasonally. And the European anchovy, which is the basis of a small but important local fishery, mostly for the domestic market. Anchovies are one of the few pelagic schooling fish that are still relatively abundant here.
So we've got breams, groupers, mullets, bluefish, bonito, anchovies. That's the native cast. Now the Suez Canal opens and everything changes.
The Lacepsian migration. And this is where the story gets really interesting. Since the Suez Canal opened in 1869, you've had a steady stream of Red Sea and Indo-Pacific species moving north into the Mediterranean. The canal was widened and deepened several times, most recently in 2015, which removed a lot of the natural barriers. The Bitter Lakes used to be a hypersaline barrier that slowed migration, but they've been diluted over time. And the Mediterranean is warming, which makes it more hospitable to tropical species.
It's essentially a one-way highway from the Red Sea into the Med.
There's some movement the other way, but the dominant flow is northward, and some of these invaders have become commercially dominant. The most important one, by far, is the rabbit fish.
That sounds made up.
Siganus ribulatus and Siganus luridus. In Hebrew, they're called sikan. They're small, spiny, herbivorous fish. They graze on algae, and they've absolutely exploded in the eastern Mediterranean. In some Israeli coastal surveys, rabbit fish now account for something like 40 to 80% of the fish biomass on rocky reefs. They've displaced native herbivores like the salema. They're everywhere.
Are they good to eat?
They're actually quite good. The flesh is white, firm, mild. They have venomous dorsal spines that can give you a nasty sting if you handle them carelessly, but once they're cleaned, they're perfectly safe. Israeli fishermen initially didn't target them because they weren't familiar, but now they're a major part of the catch. You'll see sicken in markets, you'll see it fried whole in restaurants. It's become a staple.
What's the ecological impact? If they're 40 to 80% of the biomass, they must be eating something.
They're eating the algae, which sounds harmless, but it creates something called a trophic cascade. Rabbit fish overgraze the algal forests that provide habitat for native species. The underwater seascape in parts of the Israeli coast has shifted from complex, forest-like algal communities to barrens, basically underwater parking lots, and that reduces biodiversity across the board. It's one of the most dramatic examples of marine invasion in the world.
Underwater parking lots. That's a grim image.
It's the Mediterranean equivalent of what's happening with lionfish in the Caribbean. And just like lionfish, the best management strategy people have come up with so far is eat them.
The human solution to ecological disaster. Make it dinner.
It's not a joke, actually. There are restaurants and fisheries in Israel, in Cyprus, in Turkey, that are actively promoting rabbit fish as a sustainable choice. The idea is to create market demand that incentivizes fishermen to target the invader rather than the depleted native species. Kill two birds with one stone, or catch two fish with one net.
What other Suez Canal celebrities should we know about?
The gold blotch grouper I mentioned. The red soldier fish, a small reddish reef fish that's now very common. The spotfin squirrel fish. The brush-toothed lizard fish, which has the distinction of being one of the ugliest fish in the sea and also delicious, apparently. And the Indo-Pacific swimming crab, which isn't a fish but has become a major commercial shellfish species here.
The invasive species are, in some ways, propping up the local fishery.
And that creates a weird ethical knot. If you're an environmentally conscious consumer, which fish do you choose? The native species that's being overfished and needs protection, or the invasive species that's destroying the ecosystem but is abundant and arguably should be eaten? It's not straightforward.
Let's talk about the freshwater side. The prompt mentions the Sea of Galilee. What's in the Kinneret?
The Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, is Israel's only natural freshwater lake, and it has its own distinct fish community. The most famous is the St. Peter's fish.
The one Jesus allegedly caught.
The story is in the Gospel of Matthew, Peter catches a fish with a coin in its mouth to pay the temple tax. The fish is traditionally identified as a tilapia species. In the Kinneret, you've got several tilapia species, but the main one is the Galilee tilapia, Oreochromis aureus, which in Hebrew is called Amnon. It's a cichlid, related to the tilapia you see farmed globally, and it's been eaten around the Kinneret for thousands of years.
Amnon is the one you get fried whole at those lakeside restaurants near Tiberias.
And it's mostly farmed now. Wild Amnon stocks in the Kinneret have declined significantly. The lake's water level has been dropping for years. It's Israel's main natural reservoir, and it's been heavily drawn down. And that affects spawning habitat. The Amnon builds nests in shallow water, and when the shoreline recedes, those nests are exposed.
What else is in the lake?
You've got the Kinneret sardine, which is actually a small bleak. Acantha brahma terra ascenctae, and it's the most abundant fish in the lake. It's not a true sardine, but it fills a similar ecological niche. There's the Galilean loach. There's the catfish. The African sharp-toothed catfish, which can grow quite large. And there's the Kinneret bleak, Miragrex terrazenctae, which was only recognized as a distinct species relatively recently and is endemic. It exists nowhere else on Earth.
Endemic species are always the ones that make me nervous. One drought, one pollution event, and it's gone.
That's a real concern. The Kinneret ecosystem is under pressure from water extraction, climate change, agricultural runoff, and introduced species. The silver carp was introduced decades ago and has become dominant. The mosquito fish was introduced for pest control. These introductions have reshaped the food web.
The Kinneret is basically a case study in how small, isolated freshwater systems get stressed from every direction.
It's a microcosm of global freshwater biodiversity loss, and it's a lake that matters to a lot of people, religiously, historically, culturally, but the fish are often an afterthought in water management decisions.
Let's get to the big question. How bad is it in Israeli waters?
It's bad, but it's a specific kind of bad. The Mediterranean as a whole is the most overfished sea in the world, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. Something like 75% of assessed fish stocks in the Mediterranean are overexploited. Israel is part of that picture.
75%. That's not a concern. That's a slow-motion collapse.
Here's the thing about Israeli fisheries specifically. It's a small country with a narrow continental shelf. The productive fishing grounds are limited. The commercial fleet is relatively small. We're talking maybe a few hundred vessels, mostly small trawlers and artisanal boats, but the pressure is concentrated. And there's a long history of poor enforcement. The fisheries department has limited resources. Illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing has been a persistent problem.
What are they catching that they shouldn't be?
Trawling is the biggest issue. Bottom trawling in particular, dragging weighted nets across the seafloor, destroys benthic habitats, catches juvenile fish before they can reproduce, and produces huge amounts of bycatch. There have been efforts to restrict trawling, including seasonal closures and minimum depth limits, but enforcement is spotty. A report from the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel a few years back found that trawling was occurring inside protected areas.
Of course it was.
The dusky grouper is a particular worry. Landings have dropped dramatically over the past few decades. The same goes for some of the larger breams and the meager, a large croaker that's prized for its flesh. Recreational fishing is also a factor. There are tens of thousands of recreational anglers in Israel, and while individually they don't catch much, collectively they can have an impact on near-shore species.
What about the invasive species? Are they being overfished?
Not really, and that's the silver lining. The rabbit fish, the soldier fish, the lizard fish, they're abundant, they reproduce quickly, and they're not under the same pressure as the slow-growing natives. That's why the eat the invader strategy has some ecological logic to it. If you're going to eat fish in Israel, eating the Lacepsian migrants is arguably the most sustainable choice you can make.
We've arrived at the ethical fish consumer question. Given everything we've just laid out, the depleted natives, the invasive species, the trawling problem, the aquaculture option, where do you actually go?
Let's break it down. First, the species. If you want to eat fish in Israel and feel reasonably good about it, I'd say rabbit fish, sikan, is probably your best bet. It's invasive, it's abundant, it's not being depleted, and eating it reduces pressure on native herbivores. It's also good, mild, versatile, takes well to frying or grilling.
Sikan, the ethical choice that also happens to be everywhere.
Second, farmed fish. Israeli aquaculture is actually quite sophisticated. The country has been farming fish since the 1930s, carp and mullet in ponds, initially, and now there's a significant marine aquaculture sector. Sea bream, or dennis, is farmed in offshore cages in the Mediterranean. It's a well-managed operation, the feed conversion ratios are decent, and it takes pressure off wild stocks. Farmed dennis is a solid choice.
What about farm versus wild in terms of taste?
Wild dennis is generally considered superior, firmer texture, more complex flavor, because it's eating a natural diet of crustaceans and mollusks. But the gap has narrowed. High-quality farm dennis fed on good formulated diets can be excellent. And, from a sustainability standpoint, it's the clear winner unless you know the wild fish came from a well-managed fishery, which in Israel is hard to verify.
Farm dennis, wild sikan.
Mullet is a decent option, especially farmed mullet. It's a low trophic level fish, meaning it's low on the food chain, eats algae and detritus, so farming it has a lower environmental footprint than farming carnivorous fish like salmon. And it's the backbone of Israeli pond aquaculture. The mullet you get at a good fish restaurant is likely farmed and it's likely local. Small pelagic fish like anchovies are generally a good sustainability bet. They're abundant, they reproduce quickly, they're low on the food chain. The Israeli anchovy fishery is small and mostly supplies the local market. It's not a high-profile fish, but if you see fresh anchovies on a menu, that's a defensible choice.
What should we avoid?
Wild dusky grouper, Dakar, is the main one. It's a threatened species throughout the Mediterranean, and Israeli stocks are in decline. If you see Dakar on a menu, you should ask whether it's wild or farmed. There is some grouper aquaculture happening, but it's not widespread. Wild white grouper is also a concern. Large, slow-growing predators in general, they're the ones that get hit hardest by overfishing. Sharks in the eastern Mediterranean are in terrible shape. There's a small but real shark fishery, mostly for the local Arab market. Shark is used in a traditional dish called shakshuka samak in some communities, but many of the species caught, like the sandbar shark and the smoothhound, are critically endangered in the Mediterranean. It's really not something you want to be eating.
So now the restaurant question. Where does someone go for excellent fish in Israel, with all of this in mind?
There are a few places that consistently come up. In Tel Aviv, there's a restaurant called Manta Ray. It's right on the beach, it's been around for years, and they're known for sourcing carefully and preparing fish simply. Good meze, grilled fish, fresh ingredients. It's not cheap, but it's reliable.
Manta Ray is almost a cliche at this point, but it earned it.
Then there's Benny Hadayag, Benny the Fisherman, which has a few locations, including in Tel Aviv and Herzliya. It's more of a casual, traditional fish restaurant. They do the classic Israeli fish preparations, fried mullet, grilled dennis, fish kebabs. It's not fancy, but it's honest.
The kind of place where the menu is laminated and the fish is fresh.
In Jaffa, there's a concentration of fish restaurants near the port. Some of them are tourist traps, but there are gems. I point to a place called Kalamata. It's small, Greek-influenced, does excellent grilled fish and seafood. The owner is Greek-Israeli and takes sourcing seriously.
What about up north, near the Kinneret?
Around Tiberias, the classic experience is the St. Peter's fish restaurants along the lakefront. Most of them serve farmed amnon, fried or grilled, with chips and salad. It's more about the experience than the culinary sophistication. But if you want something a bit more elevated, there's a restaurant called Dex in Tiberias that's built on a wooden deck over the water and does a respectable fish menu.
Anywhere in Haifa or the North Coast?
In Akko, Acre Bass, there's a restaurant called Uri Buri. This is the one that everyone who knows Israeli seafood talks about. Uri Jeremias is the chef owner, he's been doing this for decades, and he's obsessive about fish quality. The menu changes based on what's fresh. He serves things like sikan, like small local shrimp, like whatever came in that morning. It's in a restored Ottoman building in the old city. It's probably the closest thing Israel has to a destination seafood restaurant.
Uri Buri has the reputation of being the place where even the chef's mistakes are better than most restaurants' best efforts.
That's not far off. And Uri himself is a character. Big beard, big personality, very outspoken about sustainable fishing. He's been advocating for eating invasive species for years. He puts sikan on the menu and tells you why. So if you're an ethical fish consumer, Uri Buri is basically your pilgrimage site.
Any other notable spots?
There's a place in Tel Aviv called Gucha, which is a seafood and fish bar that's been around a long time and does things well. There's a chef restaurant called Popina in Neve Sedek that does beautiful modern fish dishes. And in the Carmel Market area, there are small, no-frills fish restaurants where you can get excellent fried fish for next to nothing. It's not white tablecloth dining, but it's authentic and often really good.
The market stalls are where you find the real food in any country.
And in Israel, the fish market culture isn't as developed as the meat or produce market culture, but it's there. The Tel Aviv port area used to have a proper fish market. Today, the main wholesale fish market is in the Tel Aviv port industrial zone, and it's worth visiting early in the morning if you want to see what's actually being landed.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier. How big a deal is fish farming in Israel right now?
It's big and getting bigger. Israel's total fish production is around 20 to 25,000 tons a year, and roughly 80% of that is farmed. The majority is freshwater pond aquaculture. Carp, tilapia, mullet, but marine cage aquaculture has been growing. There are fish farms off the coast of Ashdod and in the Gulf of Eilat. The main marine species farmed is gilthead sea bream, dennis, and there's also some European sea bass.
The Red Sea aquaculture, that's in Eilat.
Yes, and it's actually an interesting operation. The Gulf of Eilat is a unique ecosystem. It's a semi-enclosed sea with coral reefs, and there's been a lot of debate about the environmental impact of fish farms there. The farms are in deep water, well offshore, and the currents disperse the waste. But there have been concerns about nutrient loading and impacts on the coral. The monitoring data suggests it's being managed reasonably well, but it's something that environmental groups watch closely.
Even the solution has complications.
Everything in marine conservation has complications. That's the through line of this entire conversation. There's no perfectly clean choice. You're always trading off something. Carbon footprint, biodiversity impact, animal welfare, local economies. The best you can do is be informed and make choices that align with what you care about most.
Which is basically the thesis statement of ethical consumption in any domain.
And I think with fish in Israel specifically, the Eat the Invaders frame is helpful. It gives you a clear, defensible default, rabbit fish, farmed Dennis, mullet, anchovies. If you're at a restaurant and you don't recognize a fish name, ask. If the server can't tell you whether it's wild or farmed, that's information in itself.
One thing we haven't touched on is the import market. A lot of fish eaten in Israel is imported. Salmon from Norway, tuna from who knows where, frozen fillets from Asia. How does that fit into the ethical picture?
It's complicated. Imported salmon, for instance. Most of it is farmed Atlantic salmon, and the environmental record of salmon farming varies enormously by producer. Norwegian salmon farming has improved its practices significantly in the past decade. Lower antibiotic use, better feed sustainability, better escape prevention, but it's still an industrial operation with real impacts. And then there's the carbon footprint of flying frozen fish from Norway to Israel.
Local farmed fish probably has a lower carbon footprint than imported salmon, even if the production systems are comparable.
And there's an argument for supporting local fisheries and aquaculture just on food sovereignty grounds. Israel imports a lot of its food, and the more of your protein you can produce domestically, the more resilient your food system is.
The food security angle. That's going to resonate with a certain kind of listener.
And it connects to something I think about a lot with Israeli agriculture and aquaculture. This is a country that turned the desert into farmland and is now turning the sea into a protein source. The innovation story is real. But it has to be done carefully, with good science and good regulation, or you end up with the underwater parking lots.
To pull this together for someone who wants to eat fish in Israel ethically, prioritize invasive species like rabbit fish, choose farmed over wild for native species like dennas, eat low on the food chain when possible, avoid wild grouper and sharks, and, if you're dining out, places like Uri Buri and Manta Ray are doing it right.
That's the summary. And I'd add, ask questions. The more consumers ask about sourcing, the more restaurants and fishmongers have to pay attention. The market responds to demand. If people start asking, is this Sakan or is this farmed, that sends a signal.
The ethical consumer as market signal. It's not a revolution, but it's not nothing either.
It's what we've got. And honestly, the fish in Israel is good. The Mediterranean has this incredible concentration of flavor. The salinity, the warmth, the diet of crustaceans and small fish. It produces fish that taste like the sea in the best possible way. You can eat well and eat responsibly. You just have to know what you're looking at.
Now you do.
Now we all do.
One last thing. The prompt asked about overfishing being a concern. The answer is clearly yes, but you framed it in a way that's more nuanced than just the ocean is dying. What's the single thing you'd want listeners to take away about the state of Israeli fisheries?
That the Mediterranean is overfished. That's the baseline reality. But Israel's specific situation is shaped by the Lacepsian migration in a way that's almost unique globally. You have a native fish community that's depleted and an invasive fish community that's thriving, and the two are connected. The invaders are partly responsible for the decline of the natives, through competition and habitat alteration, but they're also providing a fishery that takes pressure off what's left. It's a weird, dynamic equilibrium, and it's not stable. Climate change is going to keep tilting the playing field toward the tropical invaders. The Mediterranean of 2050 is going to look very different from the Mediterranean of today.
A whole sea in transition. That's a big thought to end on.
It's a big thought. And it's happening whether we pay attention or not.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The ancient Greeks used a device called a clepsydra, a water clock, to time speeches in court, but the Yukon's indigenous peoples independently developed a similar instrument using carved bone vessels that measured time by the drip of melting ice, often calibrated to the breathing rate of a resting caribou, effectively making the caribou an unwitting timekeeping partner.
A caribou is a horological collaborator. That's a sentence I didn't expect to hear today.
I'm just imagining a courtroom in the Yukon where the lawyer's argument is timed by a melting ice bone clock calibrated to a caribou's resting breath. The pacing would be, this has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.